Jasvinavadhitamastu mavidvisha vahaihi. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Oh, nice to see you. Nice to have you back for our in-person classes. We had resumed, as you know, we resumed our in-person classes, and then maybe a month or so ago, we temporarily suspended those in-person classes because there was a surge of the virus. Fortunately, the surge is gone, and hopefully we are on our way to the end of the pandemic. We hope and pray. It's been with us now for a couple of years. We're ready to move on. Anyway, very nice to have you all here. And in our last class, we had finished Chapter 6, Dhyana Yoga, on meditation. There were a couple of questions that came on the existence of heaven or heavenly domains. That topic I've taught quite thoroughly in a series of videos on the doctrine of karma. So if you have questions about the existence of heavenly lokas, domains, you can watch the, there's a playlist on my YouTube channel, Doctrine of Karma. Today, we begin our study of Chapter 7, Jnana Vijnana Yoga. I'll explain the title in just a moment, but we'll begin with some recitation. And as always, as I'm reciting, look at the meaning, so that when you recite after me, you know the meaning of that part. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Let's check this. Maya Saktamanah Partha, Maya Saktamanah Partha, Yogam Yunjan Marashrayaha, Yogam Yunjan Marashrayaha. Asamshayam samagrammam, asamshayam samagrammam, yatha jnasyasi tachrunu, yatha jnasyasi tachrunu, jnanam teham savignanam, jnanam teham savignanam. Idam vakshyamya sheshataha, idam vakshyamya sheshataha, yajnatva neha bhunyonyata, yajnatva neha bhunyonyaj, jnatavyamavashishyate, jnatavyamavashishyate, Manushyanam sahasreshu, Manushyanam sahasreshu, Kaschit yatati siddhaye, Kaschit yatati siddhaye, Yatatamapi siddhanam, Yatatamapi siddhanam, Kaschin mam veti tatvataha, Kaschin mam veti tatvataha. Bhumirapo nalo vayuhu, Bhumirapo nalo vayuhu, Kammano buddhirevacha, Kammano buddhirevacha, Ahankarahiti yamme, Ahankarahiti yamme, Bhinna prakriti rashtadha, bhinna prakriti rashtadha, apareyamitastvanyam, apareyamitastvanyam, prakritim vidhi me param, prakritim vidhi me param, jiva bhutam mahabaho, jiva bhutam mahabaho, Yayedam dharyate jagata, yayedam dharyate jagata, etad yoni nibhutani, etad yoni nibhutani. Sarvanityupadharaya, Sarvanityupadharaya, Aham Krishnasya Jagataha, Aham Krishnasya Jagataha, Prabhavah Pralayastata, Prabhavah Pralayastata, Mattah Parataram Nanyata, Mattah Parataram Nanyata, Kincharasti Dhananjaya, Kincharasti Dhananjaya, Mayi Sarvamidam Protam, Mayi Sarvamidam Protam, Sutre Maniganahiva, Sutre Maniganahiva. That's the opening portion of chapter 7. Quite nice verses. You can see we have a lot of wonderful material to study in the coming weeks and months. You may also have noticed a pretty significant shift of subject matter. Of course, back in chapter 6, we were studying meditation, but here the focus has shifted to Sri Krishna in particular, but Ishvara, or God, in general. And that really, that shift is significant here in the Bhagavad Gita. There are two such shifts. Turns out there's a big shift between chapters 6 and 7. I'm going to show this on the board in just a moment. And a shift between chapters 12 and 13, two major shifts, because the Bhagavad Gita can be considered to be three groups of six chapters. 18 chapters, right? 666, 18 chapters. Let me show you those divisions. I'll go to the board. Where is the board? The board is here. Very good. So let me show you those divisions. Okay, can I see everything? Where am I? Okay. So those divisions, by the way, these divisions are not like a rigid outline that the text follows. This is a dialogue. We don't speak driven by outlines. But rather, when we look at each group of six chapters, we can find a predominant topic. So not the only topic, but the predominant topic. So the predominant topic of chapters 6, 1 through 6, you can probably guess what that topic is, because starting in chapter 2, we started discussing Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is the title of chapter 3. Chapters 4 and 5 were largely connected with attitudes towards karma, action. So we could say that the predominant subject matter, not the only subject matter, the predominant subject matter of chapters 1 through 6 is definitely karma or karma yoga. Further, we can say that chapters 1 through 6 are all focused on the individual and the individual's process of spiritual growth. So starting in, of course, chapter 1 is story, you'll remember that. But in chapter 2, early in a chapter, we had that very intense discussion about what is your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, the true nature which is utterly unaffected by the death of the body. So with that portion in chapter 2, starting with verse 11, began a very powerful teaching, a teaching about the individual person, the essence of the individual person. In the Mahavakya, tat tvam asi, you are that. The word tvam refers to the essence of the individual person. So we could say another way of finding a predominant topic in chapters 1 through 6 is to consider that chapters 1 through 6 are primarily focused on the word tvam in the Mahavakya Tattvamasi. Tvam, you, not you as a human being, but you as the essence of who you are, as Satchidananda. So these are two alternate ways of understanding the essence of this group of six chapters. Not that one is right or wrong. There are different ways of looking at the predominant subject matter. Now, today we begin chapter 7, and through chapter 7 through 12 form the middle group of six chapters. And you probably could figure out from what we just chanted a few moments ago, our focus has shifted to Ishvara, God, in particular Sri Krishna. And it turns out that chapter 8 is a little bit of an, what do they call, outlier. It doesn't exactly fit in. But chapter 9, we come back to talking about the nature of Ishvara. Chapter 10 is the glories of Ishvara. Chapter 11, Sri Krishna reveals his true nature, his cosmic nature, I should say. And chapter 12 is called Bhakti Yoga. So all of these chapters are concerned with Ishvara and from the standpoint of the practitioner, the content could be loosely thought as being bhakti or bhakti yoga. So whereas the first six chapters are mostly concerned with karma yoga, the middle six chapters, bhakti, devotion to Ishvara. And just to see the parallelism here, focus on Ishvara, the essence of the individual person, his tvam, the essence of Ishvara is tat. Tat is a pronoun that refers to Brahman. So the essence of the individual spiritual seeker engaged in the practice of karma yoga, the essence of that seeker is tvam, and the one to whom bhakti is directed, Ishvara or God, the essence of that Ishvara is tat, that ultimate underlying reality because of which everything exists. So that's the middle set of six chapters, which we've just begun. And later we will see one more transition from chapters 12 through to 13. In that transition, we see another shift of subject matter where we begin considering the three gunas and other topics of concern for a spiritual seeker, a variety of topics, and I don't want to spend time talking about that now. We'll have plenty of time in the future to discuss all this, but this variety of topics can loosely be called jnana. Now, not necessarily jnana in the sense of atma-jnana, spiritual knowledge, but atma-jnana, knowledge of your true self, but rather other kinds of knowledge, wisdom, which are important in our process of spiritual growth. A variety of different topics are introduced from chapters 13 to 18. The last part of chapter 18, not surprisingly, is a summary of the whole Bhagavad Gita and some ending part of the story. We'll see that much, much later. So we can say then that whereas the main subject matter, predominant subject matter of the first six chapters is karma yoga, in the middle six chapters bhakti yoga, in the last six chapters we'll say jnana yoga, but jnana in a more general sense. And just for completeness, this is not very meaningful, but it's the third word of the Mahavakya. So loosely, we associate the word asi, you are, with the final six chapters. Perhaps you can make the connection that atma-jnanam, not brahma-jnanam, self-realization, enlightenment, comes when you get that final knowledge and you discover that you are that. So asi, as you know, is a verb, you are. So tvam tarasi, you are that. So the culmination. So appropriate then to have asi as the final one. One more time, don't think that the chapters are only focused on karma yoga, bhakti yoga, or jnana, but rather these are predominant topics. Okay, that is the big picture, as they say. And now we're ready to go into detail in those middle six chapters dealing with bhakti and dealing with Ishvara. Chapter 7, the title is Jnana Vijnana Yoga. Jnana, you know, as knowledge. Vijnana, that prefix V, has a sense of something special, something more. So if jnana is knowledge, and by the way, the context here, middle six chapters, context is Ishvara. So not knowledge in general, but knowledge of Ishvara. In the title, Jnana Vijnana Yoga, jnana means knowledge of Ishvara. Vijnana means what? Something more than knowledge. We could say that it is assimilated knowledge, knowledge that's been freed from any doubt or vagueness, any pratibandhas, these so-called obstacles, or a simple one-word definition then would be realization. So jnana, knowledge, and vijnana, realization, is the title of this chapter. And again, knowledge and realization, not in a general sense, but knowledge and realization of Ishvara. So we'll see how Sri Krishna teaches that, beginning here with the first verse. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Mayas. Excuse me. Maya Saktamana Partha, Maya Saktamana Partha. Yogam yunjan marashrayah, yogam yunjan marashrayah, asamshayam samagrammam, asamshayam samagrammam, yatha jnasyasi tachrinu, yatha jnasyasi tachrinu. Excuse me. Sri Bhagavan, the Blessed Lord, Uvacha, says to Arjuna, notice that some chapters begin with Arjuna's question. Some chapters, Sri Krishna is not going to wait for his question. He knows what needs to be taught, so he doesn't need to wait for Arjuna's question. Also, just to remember, just the big picture, did Sri Krishna and Arjuna speak in chapters on the battlefield? Did they speak in elegantly constructed Sanskrit verses? So just to remind you, what we are studying here is the work of Vyasa, composed based on his knowledge of that dialogue. So Vyasa, we consider omniscient. He knew everything. So he knew what was discussed between Arjuna and Krishna in the chariot. Based on his knowledge of that dialogue, we have these verses written by Vyasa. So Sri Krishna begins by saying, Partha, O Arjuna, mayi asakta manaha. We have to break words apart. Mayi, to me, Sri Krishna says, asakta. Manaha, O Arjuna, with your manas, with your mind, asakta, focused on, attached to, mayi, me. With your mind focused on me, yogam yunjan, and practicing yoga. Now, what yoga are we referring to? I suppose this could be reaching back to, by the way, there's no one right answer. But contextually, we've just finished talking about meditation. And not meditation in general, but a particular kind of meditation taught by Sri Krishna in chapter 6, when he said you should meditate on Sri Krishna's presence within you. And when he says yogam yunjan, practicing yoga, he's referring most likely to the practice of that particular meditation technique. Yogam yunjan, meditating on Sri Krishna's presence within. Marashrayaha, Arjuna, you should be marashraya, your ashraya, your refuge, or your focal point of life should be mat, is a form of the pronoun I, me. You should be focused on me. You should seek refuge in me. This is to introduce the topic. Arjuna, with your mind focused on me, you with taking refuge to me, refuge in me, yogam yunjan, you should meditate on me, and drop down to the third line. And yata gnyasyasi, yata, the manner in which gnyasyasi, you will know, future tense, you will know, that's the fourth line. Yata gnyasyasi, the manner in which you will know, now in the third line, and mam, me. The manner in which you will know me, fourth line end, touch renu, listen. Listen now, as Sri Krishna says, the manner in which you will know mam, me, you will know me how, samagram, completely, asamshayam, without doubts. The manner in which you can know me completely and without doubts, tat shrinu, please listen. That's what he's going to teach in chapter 7. Tat shrinu. Yesu no. Same thing. Chapter 6. In chapter 6, as I said, the meditation technique Sri Krishna taught was to meditate on Sri Krishna's presence within, but he didn't really describe his own nature. He said, meditate on me within, but he didn't say, on me of such and such nature. So that's what's now going to be taught in chapter 7. The nature of Sri Krishna, which is the nature of Ishvara. Remember, Sri Krishna refers to himself constantly, not always, but frequently. He refers to himself not as Arjuna's buddy, not as Arjuna's charioteer, but he refers to himself as Ishvara, God of the cosmos. So in that way, he said, meditate on my presence within you in chapter 6, meditate on Ishvara, and here now in chapter 7, what is the nature of Sri Krishna? What is the nature of Ishvara? Touch Renu, O Arjuna, listen now as I teach that to you. Next. Jnanam teham savijnanam. Jnanam teham savijnanam. Idam vakshyamya sheshataha. Idam vakshyamya sheshataha. Yajnatva neha bhuyonyata. Yajnatva neha bhuyonyata. Jnatavyamavashishyate. Jnatavyamavashishyate. Te unto you, Arjuna. Aham, you have to break the words apart, aham, I, and in the middle of the next line, vakshyami, I will tell you, I will teach you. I will teach you what? Idam, this. This what? Idam, jnanam. Notice how the words are scattered all over the place? That happens all the time in these verses, and it happens because the verses have to follow a certain pattern of short and long syllables, and to accommodate that metrical requirement, word order gets jumbled. So, aham vakshyami, I will tell, te, unto you, Arjuna, I will tell what? Idam jnanam, this knowledge, that's the title of the chapter, right? Jnana vijnana, yoga. So I will tell idam jnanam, this knowledge, again, not knowledge in general, knowledge of Ishvara, sa vijnanam, there's the other word from the title. Sa and sa here means with, along with. Sa vijnanam, along with vijnana, along with that special knowledge of Ishvara, along with realization, that doubt-free, well-assimilated knowledge. So Arjuna, I will teach that to you. And the second line, asheshataha, completely. Completely means it's not going to be a few verses. It's not even going to be a few chapters. That's the subject matter of the middle six chapters, right? chapters 7 through 12. In chapters 7 through 12, that is the predominant subject matter, the nature of Ishvara. So therefore, he tells Arjuna up front, I'm going to tell it to you, asheshataha, completely. He begins in chapter 7, and that topic concludes in chapter 12. Yajñātvā, having understood, having gained this knowledge, jñāna and vijñāna, jñāna, understanding of Ishvara's nature, vijñāna, full assimilation and realization of that knowledge, yajñātvā, gaining that knowledge, na iha, you have to break the words apart, na iha, iha, here in the world, or in this subject matter, na anyat bhuyaha, changing the words around a little bit, na anyat bhuyaha, nothing more, jñātavyam, to be known, avaśiṣyate, remains. Having gained this knowledge, nothing more remains to be known. That's a big statement. I'm going to teach you that, knowing, Sri Krishna says, O Arjuna, I'm going to teach you that, knowing which, nothing else remains to be known. That's a bold statement. Of course, Sri Krishna is not the first to make that statement, because that's actually a paraphrase of something taught back, in Chandogya Upanishad, where the student asks, please teach me that, knowing which, nothing else remains to be known. How is it that you can understand one thing, and by understanding that one thing, you can understand everything? Suppose there are not one pot, but 100 pots, different shapes, different sizes, different colors. To know each of those pots individually, you'll have to pull, they're in a big pile. You couldn't make out in a big pile. You'd have to pull them out one at a time from that pile to see each pot individually. On the other hand, each of those 100 pots are made of clay. By knowing clay, all 100 pots are known, and that's the idea here. By knowing clay, all 100 pots are known. By knowing the underlying reality because of which these 100 pots exist, you know, you know all 100 pots. Essentially, you know all 100 pots. In the same way, by knowing the underlying reality because of which the entire universe exists, you can know the essence of the entire universe. This is what was taught in the Upanishad, and that's what Sri Krishna is going to teach here. By knowing the underlying reality because of which the cosmos exists, and the underlying reality because of which the cosmos exists, Sri Krishna is going to boldly say, I am that underlying reality. And again, he doesn't say I in the sense of Arjuna's chariot here. He says I in the sense of Ishvara, God of the cosmos. So gaining this knowledge, nothing else remains to be known, knowing the underlying reality because of which everything exists. Then, manushyanam sahasreshu, manushyanam sahasreshu, kaschid yatati siddhaye, kaschid yatati siddhaye, yatatam api siddhanam, yatatam api siddhanam, kaschin mam veti tattvatah, kaschin mam veti tattvatah. Nice. Before teaching the details to Arjuna, Sri Krishna wants to incite Arjuna's interest. Do you know, if you go to a fancy dinner, a fancy restaurant, they serve you an appetizer. So what is the purpose of that appetizer? Is to get your appetite going. Of course, I always have, you may have this problem too. when I go to the fancy restaurant, the appetizer or appetizers are so much that by the time I've eaten them, my appetite is gone. But of course, that's not the intended purpose of those appetizers. It's to whet your appetite, as they say. So here, this verse is meant to whet Arjuna's interest for gaining this knowledge. And Sri Krishna says, sahasreshu, among thousands, manushyanam, of people, among thousands of people, kashchit, hardly anyone, yatati, strives, siddhaye, for perfection, for enlightenment, for moksha. This is one of the few verses where you can actually get the word order properly in the verse. Manushyanam sahasreshu, among thousands of people in the world, kashit, hardly anyone, maybe one in a thousand, yatati siddhaye, strives for perfection. Why do so few people seek perfection? They're too busy seeking for things in the mall or on Amazon.com, wherever they're looking, which is to say they remain in the conventional worldly perspective, in which it is necessary to engage yourself in worldly activities for the sake of contentment. And the more the theory, which turns out to be wrong, but the principle or theory is, if you work harder and harder at gaining contentment through worldly activities, you will gain more and more contentment. And of course, that ends up being untrue. And many of you have discovered, as I've discovered, that the harder you work at gaining contentment, the more you discover the limitations of what you can achieve through ordinary worldly activities. You begin to discover the limitations of pursuing contentment through worldly means. And finally, you come to the conclusion that perfect peace and contentment will never, ever be found through worldly activities, but can be found through a process of spiritual growth. That discovery is rare. According to Sri Krishna, he says one in a thousand. You need not take it literally, but actually he's probably being a little over-optimistic. Of a thousand? Actually, maybe not. Of a thousand people, one person has discovered that worldly activities will never lead to perfect peace and contentment. Therefore, that person is on a spiritual path. Maybe one in a thousand is realistic. Hard to judge. So, now he takes it the next level. Yatatam api siddhanam api. But even yatatam, among those who strive, siddhanam, for protection, for perfection, siddhi means perfection, even among those who strive for perfection, even among those who have discovered the unlikelihood of finding perfect peace and contentment in worldly activities, those who have discovered the necessity of a being on a path of spiritual growth for the sake of that perfect peace and contentment, even and those people who are striving on a spiritual path, striving for peace and contentment, even among them, kashchit, hardly anyone, mam veti, knows veti, knows mam, me. Hardly any of them know me tatvataha, in reality. So among thousands, maybe one will strive for spiritual growth, and among those who strive for spiritual growth, hardly anyone, maybe one of those, will discover Sri Krishna's true nature. Veti mam, will know me tatvataha, in reality. just to play with math a little bit here, if 1 in 1,000 is on a spiritual path, and 1 in 1,000 of those on a spiritual path are successful, what are the odds? 1 in 1,000 times 1 in 1,000 is 1 in 1,000,000, literally. We use that expression, 1 in 1,000,000, which is to say exceedingly rare. So among those few that strive for moksha, that follow that spiritual path, Sri Krishna says, hardly any of them are successful in discovering my true nature, Sri Krishna says, in discovering the true nature of Ishvara. Why? First of all, it would be wrong to say that it's difficult. I mean, these teachings are, I won't say they're simple, but this is not like studying integral calculus, right? If any of you had to study all of that higher math in college, that math broke my head. I mean, I did well, but it was difficult. I had to study a lot to master all that higher math as a young engineering student. That was complex and full of complicated details. That's totally unlike what we're studying here. So this is not complex or intellectually difficult. That would be a wrong conclusion to say it's difficult. Then why is it that so few people are successful? So few people on a path of spiritual growth, so few are successful in gaining enlightenment. And that's a fact. And you've heard me give anecdotes of when I lived in Rishikesh and I met all these sadhus and sannyasis and brahmacharis who lived in Rishikesh ostensibly to live a life of full-time spiritual growth. And I learned very quickly that many of them, a large majority of them, did not seem to be particularly successful in their process of spiritual growth. Which is what Sri Krishna is saying here. Among those who do strive, even among them, very few of them know me in reality, few of them gain enlightenment. Where is the problem? The problem is twofold. The main, I don't know if we can say one is main and secondary. There are two primary problems. First problem is lack of preparation. Remember we've used the word adhikarityam? An adhikari in this context means a qualified student. That's a Vedantic definition of the word adhikari. A qualified student, and to be a qualified student is a big deal. According to Vedanta, you require lots of spiritual qualities, lots of spiritual discipline. In particular, you should have conquered raga and dvesha. That would be the primary requirement. If you remember raga, the compulsion to chase after what looks attractive, dvesha, the compulsion to run away from what doesn't look attractive, and to conquer raga dvesha would be a fundamental aspect of being a prepared student. How many can really come out of that compulsivity, that need to seek what looks good and avoid what doesn't look good? Which is to say that becoming a prepared student, becoming an adhikari, a fully qualified student, is not a small thing. It's a big deal, as they say. So that's one obstacle, one reason that so few people gain enlightenment. Even among those who strive, like all those I met in Rishikesh, few gain enlightenment for these two reasons. First reason, lack of adhikarityam, lack of preparedness, or conversely, presence of raga dvesha and a lot of other problems. Second reason is lack of access to a proper teaching. And this turns out to be a big deal, a big issue. Access to a proper teaching doesn't, you know, you're thinking, well, wait a minute, all those sadhus in Rishikesh, they all had access to the Bhagavad Gita and other scriptures. Well, if you read the Bhagavad Gita in English or Hindi or whatever is your matribhasha, if you read it without a teacher to explain what it really means, you're not going to get much out of it. I had that experience as a young man when I first read the Bhagavad Gita. Read it through, 700 in English translation. I didn't know Sanskrit in those days. I read the Bhagavad Gita through, put the Bhagavad Gita aside, and says, what's next? The irony, of course, is everything I needed to know was in the Bhagavad Gita. True. Did I need to study Upanishads and all these Vedantic texts? No necessity. If I had really understood what I read in the Bhagavad Gita, reading more would not have been necessary. But clearly, I didn't know what I had read. And it was only many years later, when I studied the Bhagavad Gita under Pooja Swami Dayananda's guidance, only then did I really understand what the Bhagavad Gita meant. This is true for any scripture. The scriptures are crucial, but they need to be studied with the help of a qualified teacher. So when I say the second problem, first problem, lack of preparation for the students. Second problem is lack of access to proper teachings. So lack of access to proper teachings probably suggests lack of access to proper teachers. And sadly, what I saw in Rishikesh and elsewhere is that many teachers are not properly trained. And it's a sad fact that many, many teachers have not themselves undergone a proper process of spiritual learning. Many of them haven't learned Sanskrit and can't read the scriptures for themselves. If they rely on translations, their translations are all ridden with errors and full and lacking clarity. So I need not dwell on this topic, but a great number, if not a majority, of modern teachers are not themselves well-trained. And if they're not well-trained, they're not going, maybe they won't really be able to help you that much in understanding the Bhagavad Gita or whatever text you're reading. So these are the two issues. So among thousands who are on a spiritual path seeking enlightenment, or here Sri Krishna puts it in a more personal way, seeking to know me, Sri Krishna says, few know me in reality, and few know him in reality because, A, they lack preparation, and B, they lack proper teaching. Okay, then. Oh, here we go. I'll explain my reaction in just a moment. Bhumirapo nalo vayuhu, Bhumirapo nalo vayuhu, Kammano buddhirevacha, Kammano buddhirevacha, Ahankara hiti yamme, Ahankara hiti yamme, Bhinna prakriti rashtadha, Bhinna prakriti rashtadha. So previously, Sri Krishna said, Tatshrinu, listen, I'm going to teach you this knowledge of Ishvara, knowing which nothing else needs to be known. Then we saw that one verse appetizer we just finished. And now we have the main course. That was my reaction here, because what we're entering into, in fact, these two verses, there's verse 4 and verse 5, in a summary fashion, give the whole thing. Who is Ishvara? Who is Ishvara is described in these two verses. Knowledge of Ishvara. And before we see it, just make a personal comment. Sometimes people ask me, what is it that drew me to the teachings of Vedanta? As you know, I was raised in a Christian family, but rejected that when I was quite young, and was non-religious for many, many years. But then, when I heard Pooja Swami Dayananda teach Vedanta, he was the first one to tell me, Ishvara is not a matter of faith. Ishvara is a reality to be known. For me, that was crucial. And it was crucial because I was not much inclined to believe anything. So the beliefs I was taught as a child, I found those beliefs very naive. And then I became a student of engineering and became one of those really logical, hard-headed people, and I just rejected all beliefs out of hand. I wouldn't consider any belief. I'm not saying that's the right attitude, by the way. That's, in general, not exactly a great or helpful attitude, but that's my attitude when I was in my 20s. I just didn't want to believe anything. I rejected any matter of faith without giving it a second thought. So with that in mind, I would not have been inclined to study any spiritual tradition, all of which includes some kind of faith. So I was turned off by anything that wanted me to believe something. And then here comes Pooja Swami Dayananda, who says, you don't have to believe. This is something you have to understand. And I needed to hear that. Belief is important. There's a role for belief. We won't discuss it in detail now. Belief is helpful. Let me say, certain beliefs are helpful. Some beliefs are not helpful. Certain beliefs are helpful. There are many kinds of beliefs in the Hindu tradition which are exceedingly helpful. But I wasn't raised Hindu, so they wouldn't help me, those particular beliefs. What did help me is Pooja Swamiji saying, this is not something to believe, to be believed. This is a matter of understanding, something you have to know. For me, that was a crucial message, and I think for many people in modern times, just to widen that out to a bigger picture. We live in the midst of a changing culture and worldview. Had we lived 400 years ago, belief was everything. And before modern science will date maybe 400 or 500 years ago. Prior to modern science, it was all the world views were determined by various religions. So European understanding was driven by Christianity. Islamic, the Middle East worldview was driven by Islam. And certainly in South Asia, the worldview was driven by Hinduism. These were all pre-scientific ways of understanding. Now we live in a post-scientific era. Science has done its job of correcting all of our wrong beliefs about the world in which we lived. So we used to believe it or not, that the sky was a giant dome with little points of light fixed in that dome. 400 years ago, you would have believed that. There's a dome up there you see at night. In day, it's illumined brightly, so it looks blue during the day, but at night, it becomes dark, and you see all these points of light fixed in the dome that is over our head. That was a prevalent worldview 400 or 500 years ago. Obviously, that worldview has long since been destroyed by science and that's a good thing. The downside of being in a post-scientific culture is we've come to the point where we say, if you can't scientifically prove it, it doesn't exist. Isn't that a post-scientific viewpoint? If you can't prove it, if you can't scientifically establish its existence, it doesn't exist. That perhaps is a step too far. For example, if you see a beautiful flower and you enjoy its beauty, can your experience of beauty be scientifically measured or examined? You can see what I'm leading up to here is the limitations of this scientific worldview. Or if you listen to some beautiful music and it brings up in you these powerful emotions, that's kind of outside the scope of scientific investigation. The point I'm leading to here is, in our post-scientific times, we've perhaps gone a little too far in rejecting that which cannot be scientifically measured and established. And in that way, all kinds of belief and faith have been wiped out in this post-scientific era, but that perhaps is a step too far. Anyway, and speaking of too far, I'm going too far off the topic here. This is just extending my discussion before about my focus, my allergy to belief in my 20s. I would say I was allergic to beliefs, and I wouldn't accept anything unless it could be proved to me. And what I'm saying is I was a product of that post-scientific thinking, and I fell prey to the step-too-far business, to rejecting so much. So as a young engineer, flowers were not very beautiful to me. That wasn't my orientation. So I think this post-scientific worldview had done some minor damage, and of course that's long ago, that's all since passed. But the point is, because Vedanta and Pujaswami Dayananda in particular presented Ishvara as a matter of knowledge, not faith, that's what drew me. And it's very important. And here, starting in chapter 7, Sri Krishna is using almost the same language as Pujaswamiji said. Notice Sri Krishna didn't tell Arjuna, I'm going to tell you how to believe in me. Did he say that? I'm going to tell you the manner, I'm going to tell you the kind of faith and belief you should have, you should hold in your heart. Notice Sri Krishna didn't use words like shraddha, faith, or vishwasa, belief. He didn't use those words. What words did he use? Not shraddha and vishwasa. He used the words jnana and vijnana. Consider that. That's really striking when you think about it. Sri Krishna himself, when he begins to teach the nature of Ishvara, begins by telling Arjuna, I'm going to wildly paraphrase him. Sri Krishna says, I'm not going to tell you what to believe. I'm going to tell you what to understand, what should be known. Okay, now let's come back to our text. So, and I reacted to this verse 4 when we chanted it because we have a lot being taught in verses 4 and 5. We'll begin. I think we'll have to continue more in our next class. But to begin, Sri Krishna, we've already chanted the verse. In the last line, Sri Krishna says, this is ashtadha prakritihi, ashtadha, eightfold prakriti. Prakriti means nature in general, but here prakriti is used as a technical term, and I'll explain that in just a moment. He says this is, you have to pick up the word at the end of the third line, iti, thus, iam, this, is may, my, bhinna, different prakritihi, my different kinds of prakriti, which are ashtadha. This is my eightfold nature. But prakriti here is used as a technical term. And let me try to introduce this. First of all, our topic here in these two verses is something scientists call cosmology. Cosmology is a science, is a study of the cosmos. How did the world come to exist? How does the universe exist? Why is there something? Why is there not nothing? These are profound cosmological questions. It's a huge and big and important topic. It is treated in great detail by the teachings of Vedanta. And Vedanta has a brilliant cosmology. It goes step by step by step to explain how the universe came into existence. Now, the Vedanta taught in the Bhagavad Gita is early Vedanta. In other words, when you study Shankara, for example, you're studying later Vedanta. But when you're studying the Vedanta taught in the Bhagavad Gita, so Shankara lived 800 years ago, this Bhagavad Gita is thousands of years old. So we are studying Vedantic teachings from an earlier era. In particular, we're studying teachings of cosmology from an earlier era. An earlier era means, instead of using the very clear and elegant way that Shankara would explain the arising of universe, the Bhagavad Gita, in fact, the entire Mahabharata, draws heavily upon the teachings of Sankhya in explaining the creation of the world, in explaining cosmology. Sankhya is an ancient worldview. That's a poor expression. Sankhya is an archaic spiritual system. It was we'll call it a cousin system to Vedanta. In the time of the Mahabharata, Sankhya and Vedanta were parallel systems, but they weren't strictly divided. By the time of Shankara, they were strictly divided. This is Sankhya, this is Vedanta. So Shankara, in his commentaries, he makes many comments about what the Sankhyas teach and how what the Sankhyas teach is different from what Vedanta teaches. So Shankara made a clear division between these two schools of thought in his time, 800 years ago, but a couple thousands of years ago, the divisions were not rigid. They were kind of mixed together. So what we're going to see here is what we'll call an archaic version of Vedanta's cosmology. Vedanta's teachings of how the world came to exist, but from this old standpoint, from the standpoint of Sankhya. And let me give just a couple of technical terms that will be helpful to understand. Let me go to the board. Okay, so this word Sankhya, is the name for this. We'll call it a school of thought. Some of you have studied what I've called the Shad Darshana, six traditional schools of thought in ancient times. And that's Shad Darshana, Vedanta was one of those six. Yoga, meaning meditation, Patanjali's yoga, was one of the six. And Sankhya was one of those six. I don't want to get into this, what are all the six, that's, I think, not important to us right now. What is important is to understand what Sankhya is. So Sankhya is a parallel teaching to Vedanta. that had a different way of explaining creation, a different kind of cosmology. And the cosmology of Sankhya is based on 24 principles. In Sanskrit, tattva. Does that come on the board? Yes. So 24 tattvas, 24 basic principles. By the way, that explains the word Sankhya. The word Sankhya literally means counting. That's what sank is the verbal root to count. So Sankhya literally means counting. Enumeration would be a more elegant translation. So Sankhya is the school of thought based on enumeration, and specifically enumeration of these 24 principles. Now, if I start teaching these 24 principles, we'll spend the next several classes doing this. And that's not really what we want to do. Fortunately, these 24 principles were brought under one category. In fact, these 24 principles got reduced to a twofold division. And this is what we need to understand our text. These 24 principles can be reduced to a twofold division. This division is important to know. It's present in the Bhagavad Gita. It's actually a main topic in chapter 13. We'll come to that much later. This twofold division, so instead of going through the 24, we're going to see this twofold division, which is a division between Purusha and Prakriti. And these are the terms I want to explain. Purusha and Prakriti. This is the twofold division which explains all of these 24 principles. Purusha, and these are, again, this is like parallel to Vedanta. This is not Vedantic language. This is Sankhya language. But since the Bhagavad Gita and the whole Mahabharata uses this language, we have to kind of know these terms, this terminology, and we have to learn a little bit about Sankhya, not the 24, but these two principles, Purusha and Prakriti. Let me sit down and explain these two. So Prakriti, the second of these two terms, is what Sri Krishna is referring to here in the end of the verse. Ashtadha Prakriti, eightfold Prakriti. And here the word Prakriti, some of you know Prakriti as nature. You look outside and you say that's Prakriti. Here it's used as a technical term. And as a technical term, Prakriti here means the world of matter and energy. I can't think of a better term. The cosmos. Prakriti, nature in the most fundamental sense, in the broadest sense, the entire cosmos here is referred to as Prakriti. And here, Sri Krishna says, Ashtadha, eightfold. What does Sankhya teach? 24. So in this verse, we are getting a reduction of the 24 tattvas are reduced to eight, which is confusing and unconventional, but we'll see that eightfold division in just a moment. But first, let's that word Purusha, we also need to understand, which will be the topic in the next verse. Purusha literally means person, but in this context, again, it's used as a technical term. So Prakriti doesn't mean nature. Prakriti means the universe. Purusha doesn't mean person here. It means consciousness. In Sankhya, Purusha means consciousness. In Sanskrit, Chit or Chaitanya, to the Sankhyas, Purusha means consciousness and nothing else. So the entire universe can be seen in this twofold, maybe I'll stay on this for a little bit. The entire universe can be seen in this twofold way as Purusha and Prakriti. Prakriti means the entire cosmos. Purusha is the consciousness who's aware of the cosmos. Because notice, you're aware of the cosmos, I'm aware of the cosmos, there is, consciousness is a fact of the universe. Consciousness is not a thing in the universe. Consciousness is the essence of who you are, who I am. Consciousness is the principle of knowing. In chapter 13, we're going to see a discussion of these two. I can keep going back and forth. So in chapter 13, instead of using the words Purusha and Prakriti, Sri Krishna is going to use the term for Prakriti. He uses the term Kshetra. Kshetra means field, and specifically field of experience. Prakriti is called Kshetra in chapter 13. Field of experience, anything and everything you experience is Kshetra or Prakriti, the known, as opposed to Purusha, consciousness, which in chapter 13, Sri Krishna calls Kshetrajna. I'm not writing these terms down. We'll study this soon when we get to chapter 13. Kshetrajna means the knower of the field. Notice this is the most fundamental division you can make, the division between Prakriti, or Kshetra, the known, and Purusha, or Kshetrajna, knower. The distinction then is between knower and known. That's simple. These two principles boil down to knower and known. Purusha, knower. Prakriti, known. Is there a third category? What would that be? Everything that exists is either knower or known. Known refers to the entire cosmos, and Sri Krishna uses the word Prakriti to refer to that known universe. In the next verse, we're going to see Purusha. The word Purusha, he doesn't use the word Purusha. I'll explain in the next class, but he's clearly, in these two verses, using the concept of Sankhya, Purusha Prakriti, knower and known, to describe the nature of Ishvara. That's a lot, and to begin at the end of this class would not be a very wise decision, so we'll save that for our next class. I'll remind you that our satsang in person is resuming tomorrow, Sunday at 6 p.m. So please join. If you have questions, please come at 6 p.m. tomorrow, and we'll take your questions at that time. And we end with our prayers at the altar? Yeah, I have to remember how we're doing this. We'll conclude with our prayers at the altar.
Om Ganana Hantwa Ganapatigam Havamahe Kavingavinam Upamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspatahanashrinvan Utibhisidasadhanam Om Shri Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Guru Ratmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanura Mardanam Devaki Paramhanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhagvaveta, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma hamritangamaya, Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
Om Tat Sat.